hearing on House Bill 3137. Mark, you want to tell us what we're looking at?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, Chairman Hill, Representative Lowe. House Bill 3136 authorizes the use of public property, including computers and other office equipment. This property of Legislative Assembly for use by the members for the purpose of maintaining communication with regular employers outside of the Legislative Assembly. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Is there anyone who would like to testify on House Bill 3136? Hearing and seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3136, open a work session on House Bill 3136.
Mr. Chair, is it going to the floor or isn't it?
It goes to the floor.
Just that we move it to the floor then.
Representative Lowe moves House Bill 3136 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
No.
And seeing none. Without objection, House Bill 3136 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Would you like to move it to the consent?
Sure.
Representative Lowe moves House Bill 3136 to the consent agenda. Discussion? And seeing none, without objection, so ordered. Thank you. Consent. Let's open a work session on House Bill 2212. First off, we'll start with Paul. You want to come up and talk about your components of the dash threes?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I represent MCI WorldCom. We just had a very simple suggestion to the no-call bill, and that was to change month to quarter, line 2, page 2. Currently, the Attorney General has advised the list administrator to prepare the list on a quarterly basis. The problem is that the law says monthly. We all like quarterly. We think maybe the law should reflect what is actually being done. So that's all the only change we asked for. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Larry, you want to come up?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lowe, I'm Larry Campbell, representing JDENT Incorporated, a telemarketing organization, and the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. And I'm here to discuss with you the importance of the passage of House Bill 2212 with its proposed amendments, Amendment Number 3. I'll start this discussion by giving a little background on the no-call list law and why the passing of House Bill 2212 with the proposed amendments is so important to small telemarketing companies in Oregon and who work on behalf of nonprofit organizations as well as the nonprofit organizations themselves. In 1999, when the Oregon legislature passed Senate Bill 915, which in essence prohibits telemarketers who work on behalf of nonprofits as well as the nonprofits from calling households that have been added to the list with some exceptions, it was never the intent of the bill to deny information that would be important to protect the people who are asking to be on the non-call list. There are three major problems with Senate Bill 915 or the law that was created by Senate Bill 915. When a telemarketer company and nonprofits are sent a new list every month, only the phone numbers are included. And this is great for large telemarketing organizations that do their calling by automatic number identification. But for small companies, there's no way of updating their no-call list unless they spend a good deal of money on a special program to convert the information. It's a tremendous burden to physically check each number against the list before calling, and also without names, we're unable to cross-reference past supporters who are exempt from the law, which keeps organizations like Oregon Special Olympics and the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police from utilizing past supporters. The law prevents small telemarketing companies, charities, and other nonprofit organizations from using local phone directories as the main source of calling. And of course, it was very simple when we had the Black Dot program, because as you went through the alphabetical listings, the information was there that you needed to keep you from calling people that didn't desire to be called. Only the larger telemarketing companies can afford to purchase the expensive automatic dialer machines, and also the smaller companies and charity-based organizations have to buy monthly lists and physically update their no-call lists on almost a hand-by-hand basis. Also, the phone numbers of registrants for the lists who move or otherwise change phone numbers are not removed from the list. Therefore, these recycled numbers are given to new customers who are on the list without their knowledge or consent. The Department of Justice has stated in a February 2, 2000 memo to Jada and Incorporated, a telemarketing company here in Salem, that it was their understanding that most telemarketers used automatic dialer machines and could simply remove the numbers from the program list. This assumption pertains to large telemarketing companies, as I've already mentioned, and not the small ones that we're mainly concerned about. As the law is currently being interpreted, and what House Bill 2212 is attempting to do without the proposed amendments is deprive anyone from using local phone directories or alphabetical lists for their fundraising effort. And small telemarketing companies and nonprofits, as I said already, have to buy those monthly lists. The law exempts calls made by nonprofit organizations to individuals who have previously donated, but again, you can't identify those with a no-call list the way it's being presently utilized. I want to give you one example of a charity-based organization that has been hit hard by Senate Bill 915 and the inability to get the list by name and address and telephone number. It's the Special Olympics from Oregon. They are a good example. Contributions and Mutual Benefit Corporation to conduct its telemarketing fundraising campaigns in the past, they've taken that responsibility over themselves. The net gain to their organization was much greater than if they had used the services of a large fundraising organization, and yet they can't get the materials that they need in order to effectively do their job. They rely on the use of local phone directories as an attempt to call everyone in the state of Oregon. Without the names of the individuals who signed up for the no-call list, they will no longer be able to use the telephone directories because of the alphabetical order. I would just point out that someone has asked the question, well, names we understand, but why addresses? The only time the address is important to us in this particular process is when there's more than one name, the same name. The idea is our folks, the attorneys from JDAN, attempted to work with the Attorney General's office through the interim, and in fact, there were several correspondents that went to the Attorney General. There was one answer, and we really didn't know until the bill was dropped that they were going to take formal action to basically make the decision that we'd asked for back in February of 2000. That decision simply was, can you provide the information? And in essence, they told us, we'll look into it, we'll make studies, we'll analyze it, and we'll get back to you. To my knowledge, no one ever got back to us until we saw the bill. So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Lowe, this is the reason why we have submitted the Dash 1 amendments, which have also been included in the Dash 3 amendments. Small telemarketers, charities, and other nonprofit organizations want nothing more than to respect the privacy of individuals who no longer wish to be called. However, they cannot make certain that their privacy policies will be adhered to due to the lack of information provided by the existing method of getting the list. The objectives of Senate Bill 915 was to protect individuals who didn't want to be called, not to penalize nonprofits who need the assistance of telemarketing fundraisers to exist. We would ask that you amend House Bill 2212 to provide the names, addresses, and phone numbers of the individuals who pay for their privacy. We also recognize that there's a question of confidentiality in providing this information, but the information is no different than the information we had under the black dot system in the directory.
Larry, how do you answer the argument that this will just become a list in which, rogue marketers would use to actually market privacy products?
Well,
how do you answer that question?
In the first place, if you're not a legitimate telemarketing organization or a legitimate charity, and they all have to file with the Attorney General's office. When you say rogue, it doesn't take them long to identify rogue organizations and take appropriate action. So my view is that what is being endangered here is the ability of nonprofits to fund themselves through this method.
May I ask a questions.
Is that wrong?
Mr. Campbell, would you please tell me who has the obligation of providing the address? Where does the address come from?
When the, my understanding is when the individual identifies that they want to be on the non-call, the no-call list, they provide their name, address, and telephone number.
Oh, I see.
And I would share with you that the address is not near as important to us, because if you had two names and one was a no-call, you'd skip that one probably if you didn't have the address. And if you'll recall, under the black dot system, there were a number of people who didn't include their addresses for confidentiality purposes. That's not our concern. Our concern is that we want to make sure that the people who are making these telemarketing calls are meeting the requirement that the people's privacy is protected and that we're not calling people who don't want to be called.
I can, having done an awful lot of calling in the recent past, myself on various things, issues. I think that if a homeowner or a resident was asked, you know, when they said, don't call me ever again, not that they said that to me that often, but just supposing hypothetically that they did, had I asked them for their name and their address and their, you know, obviously, I've got their phone number right then and there, but that would have further incensed the individual, and I'm not sure that they would have provided that to me.
Representative Lowe, I'm glad you raised that point, because the telemarketer that does the work for the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, when they identify someone who makes that kind of statement, that name goes into a no-call list that they've had. They had no call long before it was part of the state law. The problem is that there were a number of people who did call without any no-call list of their own. So I think you'll find that if someone tells you, don't ever call me again, they would be willing to tell you who they are so you darn well didn't call them again. But that is one of the things.
Whether or not the phone is crashing down in your ear at that
moment. That's a different
kind. You know?
That's a different kind.
That's a whole different deal.
But in essence, they recognize the importance of that, and that's why they developed their own no-call list very early in the game.
I also have found people are squeamish to give out a whole deal of identifying information because they fear that they might make themselves vulnerable to identity theft. And there's not a lot of trust of some telemarketing people. So have you considered whether information would be sufficient if they just gave out their street rather than their house number? Or, you know, what is the minimum amount of information that you need in order to effectively black dot somebody?
I would have to do some further checking, but I think you'd find that the minimum that we need is the name and telephone number.
So you don't really need the address.
I don't think that we would need the address. And I might point out that, your point about stealing identity theft is a concern, but if you've got your name in the telephone directory, you have that potential. The real problem we have here is that we have a group of people who don't want to be called. And not only that, but there's a tremendous fine if you don't do this right. If you call people who don't want to be called, there's a penalty associated with it. And all we want to make sure of is if we're going to be in the business of calling people, that we maintain the privacy for those folks.
Correct. The next problem that I can foresee is that supposing you call Mr. Jones, you call the Jones household and you get Mr., and Mr. says, don't you ever call here again, don't you ever call me again, and you're really selling pots and pans and you just as soon talk to Mrs., how is that handled by telemarketers under the law now?
Representative Lowe, our folks that represent the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police would put that, it doesn't make any difference whether it was the man or the woman, that would be put in a no-call list.
Okay. And do you know if that's an industry standard?
I don't believe it is.
Yeah, I don't think it is either. It's kind of a problem.
I don't believe it is.
Yeah.
But the point is that those folks have access to the no-call list that was established by Senate Bill 915. And what I'm suggesting is that ours actually go a step further. And not only will they not call the people in 915 if they can identify them, but they also don't call the ones who, as you suggest, say, hey, don't ever call me again.
Thank you, Mr. Kim.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Appreciate your time.
Christina. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee.
Hi.
For the record, my name is Cheryl Pellegrini. I'm with the Department of Justice, and the department did submit House Bill 2212. The department is opposed to the amendments just tendered by Mr. Campbell, and we are not opposed, I would note, to the amendments that have been tendered by Mr. Romaine. That would be on line 7 of the proposed amendments on page 2, line 2, delete month, insert quarter. We're fine with those amendments. We consider them to be in accord with the practice that is currently undertaken by the list administrator. The issue that the department has with the amendments that have just been tendered that we have just now seen is that the department's bill was engineered to just clarify what the existing law was. What Representative Campbell was attempting, or what Mr. Campbell is now attempting to do, is to change.
At least she didn't say speaker, right?
Is to change the intent of the existing law. If you look at the language of 646-567, 646-574, you'll note that the list administrator, that the list only contains the numbers of parties who have signed up for the list and who do not wish to receive telephone solicitations. The list administrator is authorized to provide the list as defined to telemarketers and qualified trade associations under narrow circumstances outlined in the bill. Any other information about a party, names, addresses, and such, that the list administrator is directed by the statute enacted in 1999 to only give that information to the party if they've been called by a telemarketer, to the Attorney General's office if we've received a complaint from a person on the list that they've been called unlawfully, or in the event that we had to transfer the operation of the program, we would be entitled to get that information, other information about a party, from the list administrator. But the law is clear that those are the only circumstances under which other information about a party is available to anyone. What these amendments now propose to do is to require the state to compile a list of the names, addresses, and phone numbers of people who by their very application for this program have said, I don't want to be bothered. I want privacy in my home. I don't want to receive cold calls. So now, with this list, and it's not just going to be limited to the groups that Mr. Campbell has mentioned, anybody will be able to get a customer list of people who have said, I'm interested in privacy. So the state is manufacturing a list for telemarketers to use, or direct marketers.
Let me interrupt you there. In terms of, on the one hand, you said that the list was limited in terms of a finite number of people. In terms of, do the amendments change in terms of the list of the people who have the eligibility to receive the list? Because if all you're doing is expanding what data is available on the list, and we're not making a change to whom can get the list, because you're making an assertion that people would use the list for nefarious purposes. And I would say, have you had any cases to date in terms of where people would call that list today to sell privacy issues? I mean, cause you're saying in terms of it'll become a marketable list that somebody would want to go and use it for the purposes it is not designed for.
Right. Have we had that happen?
Yeah.
No, because we haven't we haven't given out the names and addresses of anyone. I mean, the list itself is phone numbers. It's just phone numbers. So if I'm a telemarketer and I order it, it'll be each quarter now, I get a list of numbers. And I have to match that list of numbers against my call list and screen out all of the numbers on the no-call list and not call those numbers. What the amendments would do is it would allow any telemarketer now to get at the names and addresses of people who had signed up for the list.
And
they would, so instead of just having a phone number, they would have a name, an address, a phone number. They could resell that list because it's a customer list. It's a list of people who have signed up with a state-run program to ensure their privacy.
Do people resell the list, the no-call list today?
No, they don't.
I'm trying to understand the logic in terms of why you think suddenly tomorrow...
Because a list containing phone numbers, Mr. Chair, is useless. But a list that contains names, address, and phone numbers is a customer list.
So there's no restraint in those... I'm trying to understand the logic here. Just because a list contains that information, that suddenly that the very people that this is meant to help regulate, and if they called this list, would suddenly then be open to fines. And so I'm trying to see the logic here in terms of why a telemarketer would want to take the very list, which is people you cannot contact, but yet call it, and setting themselves up for fines because, I mean, that would be
right.
And stupid.
No, I understand, Mr. Chair. I think there we have two concerns. One, and I granted, for organizations that are very small that are still using Rolodex, and the only way that they can figure out who's on the list is to look at their Rolodex cards and match it, that this would be beneficial. But there are two problems. One, to answer your question directly, you're right. It's not necessarily true or at all true that list of names, addresses, and phone numbers would then be used by other telemarketers to call. That's not the concern. What the concern is that those names, addresses, and phone numbers and that list is a tailor-made list to target market privacy products to direct mail or any other form of solicitation other than telephone. So in effect, what's happening is the state is creating a list for the commercial marketplace to use to market products to people who have said they would like less contact from solicitors and not more.
Is there a medium ground here in terms of that you could go back and work to find out in terms of how you provide the information in a usable form for the small people in terms of where this is a significant issue for them in terms of just getting a list of phone numbers? In terms of the large guys can deal with just the list of phone numbers, but the small, is there room here to find medium ground so we do not, you know, create the street address, maybe limit it to, you know, last name, and city, well, and there's something in terms of that would allow them to do and try to address the problem that Mr. Campbell addressed in terms of the fact that they're working off a paper list, and if it's not computerized, it's very hard for the people who are subject to this very law to meet compliance. I mean, without, you know, and I don't think it's anybody's intention that there's suddenly this is going to be a list of privacy things, and I don't think that's Mr. Campbell's intention, but in terms of he brought some real concerns, is their ability to go and find some medium ground as to what appropriate containment of information is there.
Chair, we sure could explore it. It would have been helpful if we had known before now that this was out there. The February 20th letter that Mr. Campbell referred to is dealing with a representative for Jaden at that time, and we advised them, and we were told not that there was automatic dialing announcing devices available, but there was actually computer software available that does like a search and replace function, that once you input a phone numbers, you have to do that initially, but then each month you would just get the new phone numbers and it would just match them up, and we thought that that was a medium ground alternative and never heard anything back from them. But, I mean, we certainly, if the committee would be good enough to defer this.
How about, let's send you out in the hall, have a conversation in terms of see if there is room for negotiation. We'll come back, we'll make a decision as to whether we go forward or don't go forward.
Okay.
But in terms of after we hear back, after the, see if there's a middle ground here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let's close the work session on House Bill 2212. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2768. Mark, do you want to tell us what we're looking at? Mr. King, if you'd like to come up.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lowe, House Bill 2768 allows issuance of revenue bonds by the State of Oregon to finance telecommunications infrastructure throughout the state of Oregon. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator King, welcome.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity. For the record, we'll see you soon. Al King, State Representative, House District 44, and 2768, the purpose is to provide a local option with the support of the state funding ability to be able to do telecommunications projects only in the circumstance where this is not in competition with the private sector, and that basically would provide some telecom bonding capacity so that a local government could see some local projects that they would like to do. That they don't fit within within the capital construction plans of the telecom utility, you know, in the area, and then would allow the local government to the funding base so they could acquire, install telecommunications equipment, and then in turn be able to lease that out so that there was revenue to pay off the bonds. We brought this concept forward in the last session. I think this is a, you know, a substantial tool to give us the ability to sustain some of the objectives accomplished with the with Senate Bill 622 from last session. So we'd be able to continue on with the telecommunications abilities of rural Oregon, you know, as they, you know, need that capacity for future economic survival. I'd like to point out to you that I'm presenting that the Dash 1 amendments. The purpose of the Dash 1 amendments basically replaces the language, which was very close to the language in Senate Bill 833, but now it makes the two bills, 833 and House Bill 2768, identical. The original bill from last session had the Public Utility Commission as the operating entity. You know, of the bonds, it made more sense to be working with the Department of Economic Development. That's the substantive change for that. Mm-hmm. So that change of wording, it made it the most simple way to be able to make these, you know, bills parallel. I would you know, like to point out that I've had discussions with the Department of Economic Development. We of course want to be able to, you know, do things in ways that work for them. I've also had conversations with the Treasurer's Office, you know, to take a look at some of the mechanics of processing this. It's come to our attention that that we may be able to improve this ability by working in conjunction with lottery bonds, because there would be some delay from the time that a local government would identify a project, acquire the project, install it, and the revenue stream, you know, be coming in, which we could pay, you know, repay the bonds, and that this is something that is not today well known in the bonding market. And so if we work with lottery bonds to, you know, get it started, and use the revenue then to pay the bonds back. That provides an additional source of revenue that was not there with lottery bonds previously, that it provides an additional revenue. Yet at the same time, these bonds would be able to have the investment stature of Oregon's lottery bonds so that the market, you know, could understand them, be assured of them. So it would be possible to accomplish bonding capacity in the Department of Economic Development's traditional bonding mechanism. We could amend that to do that. But working with a bill in this way gives us the ability to work out those tools so that if it turns out that we do need to be a little bit innovative or that the size is, to get started is smaller than what, this bill allows. So we use $200 million because that, it's a big state and there's a lot to do. But it may turn out that getting going, the marketplace may accept or the municipalities may, have initial demand at a smaller amount. And certainly that would be okay in terms of testing out the mechanism as we get started. So it's possible we may have, not just a one-legged stool of the revenue from the leases or from the lottery. We might actually have a two revenue source, and that by working with a bill, we'd be able to work that out. Some of these thoughts have come to us in the last week or so, and so we plan to work that out as we go through the Senate side as well.
Can I ask a question? I'm not sure I understand, Representative King, how much of the lottery bonding capacity you anticipate that something like this would take, particularly in light of some of the other bills that are floating around this building that would soak up the entire lottery bonding capacity for some time.
It is intention that the revenues coming in on these leases for the local government would completely pay the bonds. However, it could be possible that the lottery may be involved in some partial payment in the first year, so there could be a modest amount up front which would be repaid later. So if, for example, if we have $25 million of bonding that comes out in this capacity, we would not want to be consuming any of that $25 million would come from these leases. They would pay for them completely. But it could be that the lottery bonds might be helpful in the first year or stand behind guarantee in addition to this revenue source, so that the impact on lottery bonding would be very, very small.
Can I ask another question? If you have two revenue sources backing up a debt, such as you're contemplating, does that change the bond rating? Does that help things out in terms of the project?
It can, and it could improve it. However, the bonding ability for the lottery in the state of Oregon is so strong that I don't think the additional revenue source from the local project, particularly in the first few years of implementation, will make any difference in the rating.
It's not a triple A, though. Double A.
No. That's correct. There's only the only AAA rated bond in the state of Oregon is the city of Portland on its own. The other way that you get a AAA rating in Oregon with our bonds is you buy insurance, and that in effect gives you AAA.
Really what I'm asking. If we go from a AA to a AAA, if we had two revenue sources beyond a bond,
This would not generate that level of strength. It would be an enhancement, but it probably wouldn't be so powerful that it would make our lottery bonds rated even better. I would
too bad. Okay.
Now, it's possible that if it's successful and the program goes down the road 10 years, that we could be able to have greater bonding ability and keep as good or better bond rating in the future if we had an additional revenue source. So there could be some future.
But you didn't really answer my question about how much of the bonding capacity of the lottery would this soak up.
That's something I would look at. For example, let's say that the first offer was a $25 million offer, and let's say that the first payment was due 1 year after the bonds were created. It may be that there would be zero revenue contribution from lottery bonds. It's also possible that if it was $25 million, that there could be let's say a half million dollar front end, for first payment, which would be reimbursed by an additional $500,000 plus interest at the tail, of the telecom bond.
Sounds kind of loosey-goosey. How do you nail it down?
Well, that's why we have designated smart people in Treasury Department, investment bankers. They love to work with challenges like this.
Representative Lowe, I would also note that that is not part of the Dash 1 amendments. This is an additional concept needs to be worked out, but not part of what we're considering today.
Not today. That concept's not all done today.
It's only half-baked. I'm sorry. Excuse me. That was lovingly.
Very helpful.
I'm sorry. Okay.
I do think, though, and I have worked with many municipal bond investment bankers, and this is not something that I perceive as something that would be a difficult challenge for them. I also think that it's very possible that telecom bonds would become a very popular item, in the municipal market, when we give them, a chance as maturity.
Any further questions, Representative King?
Does anybody oppose this concept?
We have people saying against the bill.
Oh, thank you.
Is there anyone else? Thank you, Representative King.
Thank you.
Call up Chuck Smith, Free State Treasury. Welcome.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chuck Smith, and I'm the Director of Debt Management of the Oregon State Treasury. And your committee administrator and Representative King both asked that I appear today and talk a little bit about the bond quality that is envisioned in Dash 1, in the Dash 1 amendments of House Bill 2768. It's extraordinarily difficult to create sort of startup projects and have those projects solely responsible to repay bonds. That's simply because of planning, timing, installation, revenue flows from the projects that need to be up and running in sufficient quantities to repay all the debt service in a timely fashion. So when you have that in a bill, it's the bonds are of a lower quality than you'd really want to try to market. There is another way, and there's probably several ways, but here's one way that I've discussed with Representative King on increasing the credit quality of these bonds, and that would be to simply sort of match them with lottery and have essentially a lottery-backed revenue bond, which is well-accepted, high quality, and we sold quite a few of them in the marketplace. That would have sort of two sources of payment. The first source of payment would be the repayment from the loans made for these telecommunications projects. However, if that source of repayment was insufficient to pay debt service on the bonds, then the bonds would be payable from lottery revenues. By making this type of arrangement, you wind up with a high-quality bond that's well accepted in the marketplace. It's a bond that if the revenues from the telecommunication projects are developed and sufficient, would not call on any additional revenues of the lottery. However, if those revenues were insufficient, lottery dollars would have to be used to pay the debt service on the bonds. But by making a combination like this, as I said, you wind up with a well-marketable, high-quality municipal bond that can be readily sold to fund these projects. And that's just the concept that I'd just like to reinforce what Representative King said.
Any further questions of Mr. Smith?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bruce Shaw. Welcome, sir.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lowe and Patridge, my name is Bruce Shaw. I represent Sprint. And I am not a bond expert, but when I kind of took a look at this bill, the thing that kind of jumped out at me was the risk the state is going to have to assume for these projects. And I think you've got to look at the revenue stream that comes back into the state or to pay off these bonds. And I think you might be able to make that a sort of assumption if you had a fairly large city that was unserved by a telecommunications carrier, and there'd be a ready acceptance, and people would sign up, and you would pretty much guarantee your revenue stream. But if you're talking about projects for rolling out advanced services like DSL or ISDN, then I think then you're into a pretty much a full-blown business case that you've got to develop, and you've got to have take rates at, you know, how many customers are going to sign up for this service at what price point. And I think, you know, if there are guarantees to the telephone companies that, you know, X number of customers would sign up for a particular service and pay for it for 5 years, yeah, we'd be in that same ball game too. I mean, you know, there's going to have to be some due diligence here, and talking with Representative King just now, you know, he's more expert in this than I am, but it just seems to me there's a risk there. And to Section 4 of the bill did cause me some problems as well in the original bill. It allows the PUC to acquire, construct, reconstruct, improve, and hold in whole or in part lands, buildings, easements, water and air rights, improvements to land and buildings, capital and capital equipment to be located permanently or used exclusively on lands in buildings that are considered necessary in connection with eligible projects. To me, this transforms the OPUC basically from a regulator into a regulator and a holder of existing telecommunications capital, and I think that's not a good role for them to be in. And for those reasons, for the risk involved in this and for Section 4, we oppose 2768. I just saw them briefly before the meeting, and I don't think Section 4 is in the dash ones as I remember, or as I looked at it briefly.
How do we, and this is sort of addressing the access to capital issue in terms of the drives, investment in telecommunications.
Right.
Sprint is, as I understand it, taking a position in terms of in their service territory is not necessarily going to drive out DSL as an option in terms of, and so in the service territories that Sprint, as opposed to other carriers in the state in terms of sort of looking to sort of deploy that as a base technology, service territories in terms of that Sprint serves as the local carrier, may or may not, depending on market conditions,
right,
have access to broadband technologies. In terms of, would you oppose in those areas, in terms of where you're not providing that service, allowing some other mechanism to do that and having access to these revenue bonds? In terms of, I mean, from understanding, it's, you know, it could be the private sector coming in and partnering to get the access to capital.
Chair Hill, I would say that we are in a consortium with other telephone companies to provide service under what we used to call the lottery contract, and I understand that contract requires that if government agencies require DSL service in a service territory, that we as part of that consortium are required to roll out the service. So if we do have the state government as a you know, an anchor tenant in that regard, then you'll see that service rolled out to other customers as well.
So in terms of the state, may, you know, in your service territory, require a single DSL line, which may not be the anchor that you're looking for. But I'm just in the absence of that,
mm-hmm,
in terms of I'm looking in terms of the consumer side of the equation. So in terms of a local cable company per se, in terms of maybe a small local cable company, in terms of and where access to capital might be an issue, and in terms of, do you oppose the formation of this in terms of the private sector coming in and able to tap a source of revenue funding to allow them to build out infrastructure to support more advanced services?
I don't think we would object to private use of capital, and certainly in our service territories. I'm sure there are cable companies that are providing cable modem service for high-speed services. I think it gets back to an issue of who is able to tap these funds and for what purpose. And if there were, I would offer this. I would guess if there were some sort of experimental use of this money to see how it rolled out, that might be acceptable to us as well. But absent that, I think there's some room for movement here.
Okay. Any further discussion? Any questions with Mr. Schwan?
Okay. Thank you.
Jenny Lang. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Jenny Lang. I represent Quest. And I'm really here today just to bring you up to speed on some activity that has gone on among the industry and some of the other players in relation to Senate Bill 833. As a result of the first hearing on it, there was interest in getting a little more information about bonding authority and how this fit in with bonding structures that are already in place at the state. So on March 9th, a group of people met at the Department of Economic and Community Development with Yvonne Addington and Mark Houston, who run the infrastructure project sections of the department, and we engaged in sort of bonds 101 and agreed that that there may be some other vehicles that would be available to do this, that the department may already have enough authority to pull this in under existing programs that they have, and that we would continue to talk with them and with each other about how we wanted to move forward. So I just wanted to let you know that those discussions have taken place, and I have abbreviated meeting notes from that session, which we can make available to you today.
Thank you. Let us have them. Thank you. Any questions, Ms. Lane?
Okay. I guess I do have the bottom line, Jenny, is it doable or not? This way.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Lowe, I think it's certainly doable. What I'm trying to make sure is that we're not creating something in addition to a structure that's already in place that's available that would do as good a job as this would do, so I don't want to recreate the wheel. I guess that's my.
In rural areas, in terms of, maybe not an issue for Quest, or I don't know, but in terms of access to capital for infrastructure development, in terms of, have you seen that as a detriment in terms of to investment in rural areas, in terms of from an industry perspective, maybe not necessarily Oregon, then you take it a notch. It's sort of the issue in terms of, that's what this is trying to drive at, is making sure that we have access to capital for investment in areas that wouldn't otherwise enjoy the ability to do that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think that access to capital is an ongoing problem, and Grant Wolf from the Oregon Telecommunications Association is also here and might be able to speak better for smaller companies. Frankly, the issue that we have sometimes run up against is that some of the smaller independent telephone companies actually have access to different kinds of capital, or if you will, or infrastructure money from rural funds that have been created over time at the federal government level or other levels to actually make them make it easier in some respects for them to keep infrastructure more up to speed, frankly, than ours. So I always a problem, but and everybody's always in search of capital, and these kinds of places would be useful to everybody, I think.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you. Dorrance, are you trying to say something? Or? Welcome.
Welcome. I'm Dorothy Kenwell from Economic and Community Development Department. I hadn't really intended to make any comments. However, I'd sort of like to echo the comments made by Jenny Lang from Quest in terms of trying to figure out how to make this bill work in coordination with an already existing program of the Oregon Bond Bank and eligibility under that program for municipalities to get grants, loans, and sell bonds for telecommunication facilities. That program has not been used for telecommunications facilities necessarily because of some other limitations that have occurred. However, I think it's worth a little bit more discussion on this subject to see how we might work out something that might be very interesting to this concept.
So in the game of moving bills about, our option here is to move this to the Revenue Committee in terms of where that may be a more appropriate discussion as to whether it gets subsumed into a Senate bill or, you know, keeping this issue alive. You know, that's my issue at this point in time as we are going to find ourselves in the next few weeks fast approaching some deadlines. So
We could do it either way. We could come back to this committee in a little while, in a short while, and tell you our best guess as to what we might do to simplify this proposal. I think if you go this way, it will require allocation of lottery bonds that are not currently now in the
Dash ones do not have any of that in it, so that's a different concept.
Okay. Okay. I just want to be sure that that's okay. Well, either way, we can surely come back in a short period of time if you'd like it to do it that way. Or you can move it on, and we can deal with it later on.
Okay.
We're glad to help with you.
Where questions are going?
No.
Thank you. Mr. Dewey, do you have any comments, your perspective? Give you the opportunity. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House Bill 2768?
Mr. Chairman, Tom O'Connor, Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities, and I guess I would also echo Jenny's comments. So we were, I wasn't there, but we had representative at the meeting regarding 833, and are interested in looking into that process. We do have a concern about, I hadn't seen the dash ones until just a second ago, and we do have a concern, obviously, about Section 5, which does change the existing authority of municipalities to both own and operate a telecommunications system in terms of these bond funds. But we are we're willing to work with look at the process or look at the at this concept with the other folks.
Okay. Representative King, we'll seek your advice. We would like to call a timeout on this and wait until movement, or
yeah, I think that'd be a good idea to, you know, to talk to people. We can certainly spend a few days, or a week. There are some new concepts that did come up recently. I think that there's some people that would like to move on to bond 102, and I'd be glad to help them do that.
May I ask one question about can you tell me about Section 5 and why there's a prohibition against a municipality both owning and operating, as they can presently do, apparently?
I'll be glad to talk to them and work that through, and I think it would be another good reason for some delay. And I should point out that the intention of this is not to create a whole new system. We're not talking about a city creating their own phone company. We're talking about buying some equipment, like a switch, to then be able to have that be operated most likely by the private sector. So I think something that some of the vendors might not realize in this is that this allows
capacity to come into existence when there might be, a zero rate of return or a very low rate of return, and that, if we do have that capacity come in, then some of the phone companies that would then operate that equipment would be doing business on phone telecommunications volume that didn't exist previously. So there's a revenue enhancement for them. So we're going to do a timeout then.
Okay. With that, is there anyone else who would like to testify on House Bill 2768? Hearing and seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2768. Ms. Lowe, House Bill 3389, this bill moved out when I wasn't here, and there was no recommendation as to passage, which is not, we can't do that. As I understand correctly, you were not comfortable or something to make a recommendation as to passage. Oblige me to move a motion for reconsideration of House Bill 3389 on the motion that needs to pass out to the floor. And we will bring it back before us. All first, Mr. The and then we'll bring it back before us and have a discussion.
Can we stand at ease for a sec?
Certainly.
Thank you.